This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Last week, we finished up our May-June issue, and the cover story has the headline, "The Presidency is Becoming the Kingship America's Founders Tried to Prevent." The cover illustration shows the presidential seal with a royal crown on the top. And we're going to start the show today by talking to the author of this excellent article. It puts what is happening politically in America today in its historical context. We're going to talk about how the checks and balances that the founding fathers established in the Constitution have been undermined and destroyed by the rise of what you might call the imperial bureaucracy. America is the biggest spender on defense and military in the world by far. But what is that money going to? It's easy to assume that more money equals more power. But we're going to look today at some shocking examples of how that money is being misspent and squandered and spent in vain. California and New York passed $15 per hour minimum wage laws this week. The kid who keeps his job and gets a boost from $10 to $15, he's certainly going to be excited. But there are significant problems with this plan, and it's going to impact the poor most of all. Trumpet writer Robert Morley will explain the true effects of rising minimum wage. And we'll conclude with a bit of instruction for those of us who are frustrated at how our memories betray us at times. We'll give some tips on how to improve your memory. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. At the time of America's founding, the Constitution set up three co-equal branches of government: the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. And this was the founders' effort to prevent any one person or small cadre of people from having too much power. It was a check on the tyranny that they had come from and that they were trying to prevent. Well, over the last few generations, the balance of power between these three branches of government has been upset quite dramatically by an increase in the power of the executive branch, with the president of the United States at the top. This trend has been going on for a number of decades, but it was really increased under the administration of Barack Obama. The title of our cover story for the next Trumpet Magazine, the May-June issue, is "Rise of the Super President." It was written by Andrew Miller. I have him here to talk about this with us. Hello, Andrew.
Good to be here.
Well, where would you say things started to depart from the checks and balances that the founders intended?
I'd say probably starting, like, very beginning, like 1900, you started to have, especially like under the Woodrow Wilson presidency, World War I, you started to get, for the first time, a president who really started writing that the checks and balances and the obstructionism, he viewed the checks and balances as obstructionism that was preventing the federal government from doing things. And so he really kind of introduced that idea to the mainstream, but it didn't really take off till a couple presidents later, like Great Depression. Obviously, Great Depression, they had a lot of serious economic problems. So under Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, the federal government stepped in and decided that, okay, we need to start making decisions more on a federal level that used to be made by the states. And now, but of course, to have an executive branch that can execute all these laws across the nation is enormous as the United States. They really started bringing in a lot of like administrative agencies like IRS and the EPA didn't come along till later, but all these like alphabet soup administrative agencies that could administer law on a transcontinental level, which the danger with that is initially, I mean, Congress had to vote to say, okay, well, we'll let these agencies administer these aspects of law. But I mean, to administer law on a continental level, there's a lot of ambiguity into the nitty-gritty details that was left up to the agencies to make themselves. So they started issuing regulations, which were like subsets of law. And as they got more and more robust, those regulations almost became more like law. And we're now, today, I've got a statistic in the article that said in 2007, Congress only passed 138 laws, but these administrative agencies issued almost 3,000 regulations springing from those laws, just micromanaging all these little aspects of government that used to be made on a local level. which became dangerous in the fact that even though it's the administrative agencies that were allowed to micromanage these laws, these agencies are still run by people who are appointed by cabinet officers who are chosen by the president of the United States. And so it's almost become like a loophole for the executive branch to just sidestep Congress. And now he can just give an executive order, officially or unofficially, to his underlings in the executive branch, and they can interpret these laws however they want.
Well, let's we'll talk more about those agencies a little bit later on, but let's talk about the president specifically. You talk about these executive actions. Maybe you could just give us, you know, in your article, you talk about this statement from Barack Obama: "I have a phone and a pen. If Congress won't act, then I'm going to go ahead and just do it myself." Maybe you could give us some of examples of the actions that the president himself is taking today that have become a matter of routine that people have come to accept, that really do demonstrate a massive increase in the amount of power that that office holds.
Well, probably the biggest one, and the one I spend the most time on in the article, is the immigration reform one from his 2014 State of the Union address, to where they'd proposed immigration legislation to Congress. Congress didn't pass it, and so he'd given his big speech. He made his comments about the pen and the phone at a press conference right before a State of the Union that said, "Hey, I have a pen, I have a phone. If Congress isn't going to do this, I will." And then the shocking thing, that at the State of the Union address, he pretty much said the exact same thing. And I mean, really got shockingly, I'm just like reams of applause, I believe, from both sides of the aisle.
And what's interesting is the fact that Congress would not support what he was doing. That is actually, people call it gridlock and they look at that as a negative, that the government isn't accomplishing something. But that's precisely what the founders intended to happen, so that you didn't have somebody who could unilaterally enact legislation the way that he's proposing to do.
Right. James Madison had said that the concentration of power in any one branch of government is the very definition of tyranny. So that's why we had three branches that in some ways act against each other to be able to prevent every one branch from just acting unilaterally like the Obama administration has done and is still trying to do. And the other thing that... In
one sense, it's really quite a successful PR coup for the White House to essentially characterize anything that isn't the fulfillment of its desires as a stonewalling and a failure to fulfill their constitutional mandated position to back up what he's doing, and that deadlock in Washington politically is a sign of things not working the way they should.
Yeah, it's a major PR coup, because the president's really painted this like, well, America doesn't have immigration law, or the nation's suffering because there is no immigration law. Congress is just obstructionist and they refuse to give us immigration law. So with a heavy heart, I have to step in and do this. When the fact that, no, America does have immigration law, and the problem with it is the executive branch has been refusing to enforce it.
Right.
And so since they refused to enforce it, he came up with this new law that they're present. And Congress, he says, well, Congress didn't act. I'm like, no, Congress did act. They said no. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically saying, it's like, well, we've got a good idea. How about you enforce the laws we passed last decade, and if they don't work, you can get back with us and we'll see if we need to make any changes. But so your position is this: and no, I'm refusing to enforce the laws on the books until you pass this new law that I want. And if you refuse to pass that law, well, then I guess I'll just have to step in and instruct the Department of Homeland Security to just do it anyway.
So this really does lead into going back to what you were talking about earlier with all of this alphabet soup of government agencies. This article describes it as a fourth branch of government, and there are a lot of people looking at this and saying, you have your executive and you have your legislature and you have your judiciary, but you also have this massive regulatory morass of federal employees. But in a sense, they are beholden to the executive branch, or it's somewhat of an extension of the executive branch, and the way that they're operating is actually implementing the desires of the presidential administration.
Right. I mean, they do have a bit of autonomy within those agencies, but they are still run by people who are appointed by the executive branch. And so if they refuse to do what Congress wants them to do, Congress really doesn't have any way to rein these agencies in. If they refuse to do what the president wants them to do, I mean, the president still does reserve the right to sack the head of the agency and replace it with a friend of his who will give orders more in line with what he was thinking.
Right. And all of this is happening at the expense of state power.
Right. And I mean, that is that's another amazing thing about the Constitution is when the framers were designing it, really the only model some of them had to go off was like back in Greece and Rome. And they knew in Greece and Rome that these republics worked fairly decently on a city-state level. But once they started to grow towards like empire size, they didn't function anymore because the empire was diverse. And when like sort of the Roman Empire, people in Britain thought different from people in Greece. They couldn't come to a census, to a consensus. And eventually the gridlock got so bad you just had to take the standpoint of let Caesar decide. And he'd make policy for the whole empire. To prevent that from happening in America, the founders realized that people in Massachusetts and Texas aren't going to agree on how to do things. So they're going to divide it up into 50 self-governing units. That way the decisions can be made on a local level, except for like foreign policy decisions or international trade decisions. The federal government could make those for everyone, but it was very restricted.
Specifically
and very specific.
Enumerated powers that belonged to the federal government rather than the states.
It wasn't until around the Great Depression, World War II, the Franklin Roosevelt administration that the federal government stepped in to start regulating the economy, hopefully to prevent another depression. And the federal government took these powers, and then so you did have a federal system running the entire continent, and the couple thousand people in the executive branch, the burden was too great to manage an entire continent. So they just keep having to hire more staff and make more agencies until you had this huge administrative state that could administer government all across the nation. And but for that to work, I mean, it was unconstitutional, but Congress had to delegate a certain amount of lawmaking responsibilities to these agencies. And I mean, once they delegated it, they didn't have the power to rein it back. And so in a way, our separation of powers has evolved into a point where now the president can take power from Congress, but Congress can't stop them.
Now, you talk about this delegation of power to the states, and one of the specific examples that is really interesting, and you discuss this in your article, is that of law enforcement. And the federalization and the nationalization of law enforcement, this was something that was very specifically delegated to the local on the local level for a specific reason.
Right. I mean, in the Constitution, it was pretty much just piracy, treason against the United States, and counterfeiting, which were specifically listed as federal crimes that could be federally policed. Everything else was delegated to the states. And for about the first 100 years of American history, they operated under a constitutional interpretation called dual federalism, to where it said if the Constitution doesn't say the federal government can do it, it's understood to be a state's issue. It was, again, during the Franklin Roosevelt administration, they'd kind of found a way around that in that what they called cooperative federalism, where the federal government would tax the people and then tell the local police departments, they say, well, we can't force you to do what we want, but we'll give you money if you do. Mm. And so they started getting a lot of this cooperation between the local police departments would give data or arrest data to the federal government, and then they'd give them money back. And it blurred the line a bit to where – and now they're starting to find out that once you've signed up for some of these cooperative things, you can't go back on it. To where I think one issue in the Ferguson Police Department is they after some of the riots – after some of the Ferguson riots, they'd signed up where they, in return for federal funding, they were going to allow the Department of Justice to come in and give their police officers some training on how not to be racist. And then they were eventually finding this was very expensive and the voters weren't happy about it. So they're like, well, maybe we'll just we'll reform our police department ourselves. We'll work within our city council. And they got a huge lawsuit put against them by the Department of Justice, which was so expensive that they eventually backed down and like, all right, well, we'll let Washington, D.C. tell us what we have to do and we'll do it.
So the logic that the founders had in establishing local law enforcement rather than federal law enforcement, the logic that's being violated by these kinds of arrangements that you're describing, what was it that made it so important to them to keep that local?
Right. Well, at the time, almost all of Europe was policed by federal police, which were pretty much like a private domestic army for the kings and monarchs. And I mean, any time there was any sort of dissent against the monarchy, he could just send the police to kick your door down and arrest you and put you in a dungeon. And so they didn't want that to happen here, where just one man and or one political party in Washington could use the police to crack down on anyone who talked about espousing a different viewpoint. So they made a system to where the people actually elected their own sheriffs. It prevented tyranny, and similar to the states, dividing up with the states, it also made the police more in tune with the local needs. I had read one article, even in the case of Baltimore. After the riots in Baltimore, they really started talking about, well, we need to nationalize the police so the federal government can step in and make sure they're not racist. And one of the people said, the interesting thing with Baltimore is the mayor was black. Over half the city council was black. The sheriff was black. Over half the population was black. If all those voters can't reform their own police department on the local level, what makes you think a nation that's 85% white can do a better job for them?
Yeah, interesting question. This article, Rise of the Super President, this is the cover story of the next Trumpet magazine, our May-June issue. We just sent this off to the printer last week. It'll be appearing shortly on thetrumpet.com, and you can read Andrew Miller's cover story. Just a fascinating story. There's so many aspects to this that are really, really relevant to what we're seeing happening today. It's good to set what's happening today in its historical context and to recognize just what an anomaly this is, or how huge of a departure this is from the founder's intent, and why it is something that really should trouble us all. We've been talking with Andrew Miller, and look for his article, Rise of the Super President, on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
All right, thanks for having me on the show.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
America spends a lot on its military. In 2013, global spending on defense totaled over $1.7 trillion, and America's spending accounted for 37% of that total. The U.S. spends about as much on its military as the next nine biggest spending countries combined. So this is an argument that we hear from the White House as it cuts the military budget. Okay, we're cutting back, but we still spend far more than anyone else. We still have the most awesome, most advanced military in the world. But the question arises, where is all the money going? Is it accurate to think that more dollars equals greater power? How is the defense budget being used? There's actually a biblical prophecy that we draw attention to from time to time about America spending its strength in vain. And when you study into it, you see there's actually a lot of spending going on in vain, a lot of projects that are squandering defense dollars that don't actually contribute to a stronger America at all. This is an important subject. It's a prophetically significant subject. And to talk about some of the examples of this, we're going to talk with a man who's been following this subject closely for many years. He has a great interest in all things military, the chief financial officer of Herbert W. Armstrong College, Andrew Locher. Hello.
Hello. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So last week, this story came out about this billion-dollar sub, the USS Minnesota, this attack submarine. And there were some problems with its manufacturing that make it so it's not going to perform as advertised. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. This submarine was a $2.7 billion project that was hailed as a great achievement in building submarines. The construction was completed months in advance, and it was one of the first times, really, that the Navy was able to field a boat that they had paid for to field it early. But very soon after deployment, they discovered some flaws with the construction. This $2.7 billion boat was dry docked because of a $10,000 part that was manufactured not according to specs. It was known by the manufacturer because they have evidence that they made cosmetic welds on this particular pipe so it would pass inspection.
So the people who were responsible for that one part, basically they knew that this is something that would sideline this entire project. $2.7 billion sub that was rendered useless by basically a manufacturer who was just unscrupulous in what he gave, how he completed the job.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is the defect would not create like a nuclear meltdown. The risk was that it would vent steam into the sub or it would leave it dead in the water. And obviously that's a horrible problem for a submarine to have. And the investigation or the story came out that because they determined there was fraud by this manufacturer, they went back and looked at their work after the fact, after the Minnesota. There's two submarines that are under construction, one just recently deployed. And they found the same problem on those two new attack submarines.
So three massive subs, all that took a lot of expenditure, ineffectual.
Absolutely. And it's shocking in that we are replacing aging attack submarines. And so this not only keeps our boats in port, but we're having to field older equipment that's less reliable. And the billions that are spent on these new boats, it's just leaving a lot of question among the Navy. What else is defective? What else has not really measured up to spec that leaves their boats either inoperable or at least dangerous to run?
And that was an American manufacturer.
It was an American manufacturer based in Florida.
Because we've also talked about instances where you've had the military subcontracting parts out to foreigners, and you have the possibility of Trojan horses. You have computer equipment or microchips that have that have something that could be used as a back end for a foreigner to come in and to render something inoperable. But this is homegrown.
This is homegrown. It's sloppy work. And again, what makes it, I think, especially egregious is the fact that this whole construction process was rushed along to produce this new weapon ahead of schedule. And there was time, you know, in the budget to allow for proper construction. But now, as a result of this one part, they've got their three newest submarines have been dry docked.
We were talking a few weeks ago with Richard Palmer about the F-35, the super advanced technology behind this project, and I think it's something like $1 trillion that's being invested into this plan, and yet the vulnerabilities that are there because of the reliance on the super advanced technology are just catastrophic.
It is amazing to consider all of the vulnerabilities for technology. A lot of the argument that you hear from defense officials these days are we can have smaller forces, we don't need as many ships deployed because the technology of a current warship is so far surpasses what was, say, a World War II era that it's not necessary to have all of these boats. The counterside to that is if technology keeps them, you know, bottled up, or if the technology is compromised, we're left with essentially nothing. We're building weapon systems that are so reliant on technology. They have smaller crew sizes. There's less threat of losing human life if something does go wrong in a battle. But it really leaves us wide open.
So what are some of the other examples, specific examples of major expenditure, of putting a lot of eggs into a few baskets that end up not really yielding any results?
One of the greatest debates right now is with the U.S. triad nuclear posture, where we have land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles that carry nuclear weapons. We have, of course, jet aircraft and then the submarine fleet. The new START treaty is requiring or will result in a greater percentage of the nuclear weapons being deployed in submarines. Up to 70% of our nuclear weapons will be submarine-based. And the Air Force has come out, and they've asked to upgrade all of their intercontinental ballistic missiles, the ICBMs. And it's a really interesting debate right now because the technology there hasn't changed too much. The cost of upgrading is fractional compared to building these new submarines. But even former Defense Secretary William Perry came out and said that those missiles are of no value to us anymore. They're only valuable in a threat from Russia. And so we're having this debate on where to spend the money. We obviously are struggling with budget issues. The Air Force wants new missiles. The Navy wants new submarines. The Air Force also is wanting to develop new long-range bombers. And so there's a fight for the dollars, and the dollars that are being consumed in many ways, it's just a very difficult process. do we invest money in the land-based systems that are somewhat obsolete? And yet there's strategic value to those. And so the questions that the administration faces, they really are kind of challenging. And that's where, again, I think they're tending to lean on technology.
So looking at some of the threats in the world today, you look at the kinds of moves that Vladimir Putin is making with Russia. You look at some of the problems that are facing Europe today. And America has really had its finger, and in Asia, we've had a presence in a lot of different theaters, and it's really costly to maintain that kind of a posture in those areas. How is the military responding as those threats increase in a lot of those places? We're pulling back. What's the logic in where we direct the resources that we have as those diminish in order to counter some of these threats?
That is the difficult question. And I think, again, they're falling back on technology responses. And with the growing threat, say, in the Pacific, we're really at a disadvantage there.
Another aspect of this that I think is really interesting to look at is you look at, say, somebody like ISIS that is using a far lower budget, but they find ways to really get a big bang for the buck. This asymmetric warfare kind of a mindset, and we've talked about even the way that in America's reliance on technology, if a foreign power can knock out a satellite or they can take out some key component of that, then all of a sudden you render this high dollar piece of equipment completely useless. Are there examples of foreign powers that are basically finding ways to neutralize some of these really impressive weapon systems that the United States has created?
Yes, actually, last week another article came out about, it was entitled, "Are Doomsday Submarines Doomed?" And building weapons platforms in an established defense department, say the United States, we're projecting weapon systems that we'll be using 40 years from now. And so we're trying to use new technology to create these very futuristic weapons. But what's happening is some of the countries with much less money to spend, they're finding ways to destroy what now is 20 or 30-year-old technology of the U.S. while still super advanced compared to others. They're spending a fraction of the cost on a weapon that will have a maximum impact. Say, take out an aircraft carrier or one of our nuclear ballistic submarines. This article here talks about underwater drones and the advances in technology in just the last few years. Technology advances in battery life and underwater communication that allow them to build these drones to either detect or perhaps even attack a multi-billion dollar boat with maybe a $100,000 missile that can render it useless.
Boy, that's amazing. If you're planning out 30, 40 years in advance and you're trying to anticipate threats and you're basically designing the weapon systems that you're going to need for threats that haven't even necessarily materialized, that's a really slow moving ship to try to change direction or alter the course based on new realities as they develop. Whereas with some of these other entities and terrorist groups, they're extremely nimble and able to make those adaptations very quickly.
That's right. You see that in the terrorist strikes throughout Europe, that we have well-established security systems at airports and police departments, and yet a couple rogue individuals with a little training can really wreak some havoc with navies. Again, you have billions of dollars invested, and it's very easy to overlook the current technology and how, again, that's the current technology is 20 years advanced from our infrastructure that was developed 20 years ago. But what we find is these drones, they can be at sea for a long period of time. This article used the example of during the Cold War, the United States had deployed these underwater sound sensors. And every time the Soviet Union would put to sea one of their nuclear submarines, these sensors, very inexpensive sensors, would pick up their movement. And then we would just shadow the movement of that Soviet submarine with one of our attack submarines. And really, it was a major advantage the U.S. and their allies had during the Cold War, because we knew every time the Russians moved one of their subs. And we were able to follow. And today, that's what they're finding is these other powers like China and some of the other nations that don't have as much money for their Navy budgets, they're building these drones that are capable of detecting our submarines. And it's like the table has turned, and now we're finding ourselves, you know, trying to remain stealth and keep this advantage. And yet these foreign powers, for a fraction of the cost, have removed all of that advantage we once had.
You also have to wonder how much espionage factors in. It's really expensive to be the trendsetter and to do all of the research and development in order to create some of these technologies. It's a whole lot cheaper to steal that information.
It really is. That we rely on that new technology as well. The advancements in battery life is a major benefit to the U.S. Navy. And we, too, create our drones. But the problem is it's such a common technology. And with espionage, with international studies overseas, you know, it might not seem like that big of a deal to have a Chinese national attend Harvard and study how to create better batteries. You know, maybe it's for a piece of electronics for like a consumer grade, or it can transfer that technology into their military and again render our very expensive technology useless. And so it is a two-edged sword. We need the technology, but creating that also empowers our enemies.
Well, you also see so many instances where you have an American innovation that ends up appearing on a Chinese piece of equipment, and it's, you know, basically they just stole it. There's so many instances of hackers getting into our systems and drawing on some of the information that we spent so much to come up with. Even there was that instance where that stealth fighter was shot down. The Iranians captured it and basically looked, you know, they got all of the secrets that they could from it and then handed it back after they had already gained all the benefit from it.
That's right. Even the operation to take out Osama bin Laden, one of our new stealth helicopters, was also left behind and mostly destroyed. But again, some of the technology escaped us there and fell into enemy hands. So it's very easy to forget about the research and development costs, the years that go into that planning, the billions of dollars that is spent trying to develop that technology. It's deployed and then immediately lost. And so it cost us, you know, years of time, billions of dollars, and then it very quickly falls into enemy hands.
So you were telling me about the commander of the U.S. Submarine Force, the statement of intent that he made last December. Can you just tell us about that?
Sure. He stated the situation that the U.S. Navy is facing, and he draws attention to the fact that 90% of global commerce travels not by plane but by ship, and 95% of intercontinental communications, including financial transactions, travel not by satellite but via underwater cable. And his intention for the submarine force that's under him is to respond to that critical need of the United States. He goes on to explain the challenges that they'll face in protecting those vital communication assets. And he lists Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran as the chief threat to those communications and commerce. And that's what makes this latest revelation that our most newly deployed submarine is, you know, has these serious defects. And it seems especially criminal that those defects come from poor workmanship and from a domestic manufacturer. Not only is it frustrating that they have the defects, but they went to great lengths to hide those defects, committing fraud and really making our systems even less useful.
Yeah, it really shows putting self-interest over the interests of the nation and the safety of the sailors and the security of the country. Really pretty shocking example of human nature at work. You know, this passage in Leviticus 19 that talks about America spending its strength in vain, it describes that as a curse on this nation. And it's something that not a whole lot of people looking at these problems would say, well, this is a real curse on our nation. They wouldn't necessarily use that term. But I think anybody looking at the facts has to be frustrated and angry to see these kinds of the way that this money is being mismanaged and misdirected, and to continue to characterize America's military power as just preponderantly great because of the expenditure that we make really is ignorant of a lot of these realities that show just how much we're undermining our own power by through this curse that we're suffering. Well, this is a subject we're following closely. We're talking with Andrew Locher. He's agreed to write an article about this for thetrumpet.com. We look forward to reading that article, and thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
$15 minimum wage. Hooray! This week, California and New York passed laws that a lot of people have been fighting for quite a while. $15 per hour minimum wage. The kid at Burger King, who was getting $10 before, if he keeps his job, he's thinking, hey, this is fantastic. But all is not well in the land of the $15 minimum wage. There's a lot of evidence that this kid at Burger King and a lot of poorer people are the ones who are actually going to suffer because of ill-conceived laws. I have trumpet writer Robert Morley here to explain the truth about the effects of a $15 minimum wage. Hello, Robert.
Hi, good to be here.
Why shouldn't people be celebrating about this?
Well, you hit the nail on the head with your introduction when you said, if he keeps his job. And that's a loaded phrase because on both sides of the political spectrum, people arguing this question, they're going to argue about that fact. Will people keep their jobs when you raise the minimum wage by 30%? This is what is happening in California. This is what is happening in New York now. Both states have signed this new law into place. So their minimum wages, which were, I think, 10% or $10 per hour in California and $9 in New York, over the next several years, they'll be stepped up a dollar per hour per year as they head towards 2022. And they hit their $15 per hour. Now, a lot of academics that are for this, they'll say, well, look, we've raised the minimum wage before, and we haven't had massive job losses, and you know, life has continued. And so we need to keep on doing more of this, make things better for people. Well, I think it's a very, very silly argument in the first place, because no matter how much you study what has happened after you raise the minimum wages, you don't know what would have happened had you not raised the minimum wages. So, for example, population just grows naturally because of, you know, we have a growing population and immigration. So we're going to naturally have more jobs. So to argue that raising the minimum wage didn't have an impact because there were still jobs after it, you have to fall back on real world experience. Talk to companies, managers, small businesses and say, okay, what is the effect? What's going to happen to you when your labor costs rise 30%? And that is the reality that's going to be facing many people in California and New York shortly.
Well, let's talk about that. On the face of it, essentially you have politicians making these promises to people who are getting minimum wage, and they're saying, we're going to make your life better because more money equals better life, right? That's almost the depth of the argument that's being used. So let's break this down. I mean, we need to talk about the reality at the most basic level. Why are the wages where they were before they were raised? Why was it only $10, or, you know, we could say only $10 or only $9 before that? What was keeping it at that level? Why is it that an employer is only willing to pay that much for a person in a particular job?
That's a great, great question. And the answer is, products and services have value and they're worth something to different people. And in a free market economy, wages, like any other product, are set by laws of supply and demand. And politicians thinking that they can come in and change that artificially and not have consequences is really, really naive. That's not the way it works. In a free market economy, demand for certain skills is going to pay a different amount than various other skills. So that's why you get lawyers. One reason why, if you know somebody who goes to school gets a specialized trade, they're not competing with, you know, 10 million other people in that field. Their skills are worth more. They're providing a different service, whereas many, many more people, the bar to entry to be a landscaper or to be, you know, I don't know, a street sweeper, or you pick whatever it is a lot lower. And the demand for those jobs, you know, they simply, those jobs simply cannot provide a service that's worth more or worth more money. So you command the wage that your skills can provide, what you can bring to an employer, or what the service you can provide to a community. That's basically what, in a free market economy, is going to set the level of wages.
So an employer says, you know, I have work that needs to be done, and with the business running the way that it is, I can provide this much money to see that this is going to get done. Whoever wanted to do this, based on what we're earning and our business model, I can pay some kid $5 an hour to keep the shop clean, or that type of thing. A law like this basically says, nope, if you're going to hire somebody, you have to find a way to come up with another $10 an hour to hire that kid. And the employer says, well, maybe I don't, you know, I can't make that work. So therefore, I'm going to have to figure out some other way to get this work done.
Absolutely. Maybe I'm going to shovel my own sidewalk in the wintertime. Maybe as an employer, like you said, the shop floor is only going to get swept once a week instead of three times a week or whatever it is. These are the very real decisions that business owners across the United States have to make, because so many businesses, if you're a business owner, you know, and many businesses, your margins are very, very thin. There are millions of businesses across America that are eking out a survival. They aren't growing gangbusters. They aren't all Googles and Microsofts and you know, these high-flying
right companies. And especially a smaller business that's competing against you know, a Walmart or a larger chain that has a greater margin for error in purchasing things, they would be even more living on the edge, and where a dollar or two difference for a wage would make a bigger difference for their bottom line.
Absolutely. And I think we will see a disproportionate impact on small businesses versus the large businesses, because like you said, these bigger businesses have economies of scale where they can squeeze more and they can adjust a little bit better. I mean, it will impact them too as well. There's no doubt about it. And there will be job losses from bigger companies too. But it's the small guys that are going to be squeezed out. And that's the exact demographic that so many of these politicians are saying that they are trying to help. You know, the poor people, those just trying to get things going. And it's going to have the actual opposite impact from what they're telling the voters that it's going to have.
So essentially, anyone whose skills don't warrant a $15 an hour wage, anybody who from this point, if they're worth $10 an hour, up to $15 an hour over the next few years, a lot of them are going to find themselves out of work.
Absolutely. A lot of these are entry-level jobs that we're talking about here. First of all, the conversation in America, so much of it has been about, you know, people can't support a family on minimum wage. Well, look, minimum wage jobs, entry-level jobs, you know, so many of these jobs, if you're trying to provide a you know, for your family on working at McDonald's, you have some other issues that you need to take care of, ambition issues, education issues. I mean, you can go down.
Right. The McDonald's entry-level job wasn't intended to support a family.
Absolutely. There's jobs like that across. Why should every job in America pay a level to support somebody's family? I mean, that is what politicians are telling people. Every single job in America, as you as an employer, you have to pay your person a living wage that they can support a family on. And does that make any economic sense at all? That's the question. And I would argue that makes absolutely no sense. Some jobs are there because the value to them is so low that, you know, maybe I'll do it myself. But if I can pay someone $5 an hour, $6 an hour, $7, okay, yeah, a kid down the street can come and do that, right? Right. I'm happy to do that. But now politicians in their wisdom have decided that none of that is valid work unless you pay, you know, $15, a living wage, you know, quote unquote living wage, somebody can support a family on.
So let's talk about some other effects. Yeah. McDonald's, it appears they've actually come out in support of the $15 an hour minimum wage because this will provide the economic incentive for them to mechanize some of these entry-level jobs. Maybe they've been wanting to go that direction, but it's made more economic sense to pay someone $10. But now that it's a $15 wage, then they'll go ahead and get the robots and eliminate those positions.
Yeah, that's exactly what McDonald's has been accused of. A lot of industries similar in fast food, these low margin jobs where low skilled employees, repetitive type labor movements, they are going to mechanization. They are going to robotics. And this absolutely will speed that trend. And once again, here we see an effect where the politicians are causing the very things that they're trying to stop. We're trying to help the poor people have a better life. But what this is going to cause is more job replacement. And this is a trend that's already in place. But when you jump the minimum wage 30%, this isn't talking about tweaking around the margins here. 30% addition to labor cost, this could lead to a lot of replacement. And I think that is one of the big trends we are going to see going forward. Everything from the trucking industry, long hauls, driverless vehicles, that's a trend that is coming. Fast food industry, the machines, the robotics are already there. The industry is already adopting them. This is just going to speed that trend up. And there's a lot of industries in that we're going to see unexpected job losses. And it's, you know, it's one of those consequences from meddling in the markets.
Any other major effects that you see this?
Absolutely. Labor costs. Anytime you raise labor costs, you're talking about making businesses less competitive to their foreign counterparts. So looking forward, we can look for America's trade deficit to increase. We can look forward to more offshoring. We're seeing factories close all the time and shipping operations overseas, because where labor costs in America are now $15 per hour, plus health benefits, plus, you know, all the pension layaways and everything else you have when you're talking about unionized labor. Some cases you could be talking for a minimum wage worker, $30 an hour in actual benefits. Mm-hmm. And then you can contrast that to somebody in Mexico who's working for $2 an hour, benefits included, and they're happy with that down there. Mm-hmm. So we'll see a continuation of that trend. I think we're going to see inflation, because what businesses can pass on the price increase, they're going to pass it on to everybody. So that means your paycheck, my paycheck is going to go less far than it has in the past. Everything from food collection industries, harvesting, agriculture, their costs are going to go way up. We're going to see people on fixed income get hurt disproportionately, because their incomes are not going to rise with this. They're stuck with what they earn, but yet their costs are going to increase. I think we're going to see many cities across America see their budgets blown out, because many of these, especially the poorer cities, you know, they're paying city employees to, you know, mow the lawns and keep the parks clean at minimum wage level, or maybe just slightly above that. And all their costs are going to go up as well. And we see many cities in the United States already having budget issues, and this is just going to exacerbate a lot of those problems.
So a whole lot of negative ripple effects, and that begs the question, why in the world, given all of the negative effects, which don't require a tremendous amount of imagination to foresee, would politicians support a $15 minimum wage?
Well, I think New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, he summed it up pretty well. Yesterday, he was on stage with Hillary Clinton talking about the minimum wage. And, you know, now she's a big supporter of the $15 minimum wage. Before, she thought 12 was where it should be. Now, you know, slowly it's crept up. Now it's 15. But he said, quote, "We want economic fairness. We want economic justice. We want it now. People are angry. Yes, not only in this state, but in the whole nation." There is a certain anger in the United States. There is a sense that economic conditions are deteriorating. And I think those are very valid observations. If you do look across the country, there is problems with affordability. There are problems with standards of living in this nation. And I think there is a very real sense among people that the nation needs something to change, that something needs to be fixed. And I think politicians are tapping into that. And I think that on both the left and the right, we see the politicians tapping into various elements of that, whether it's Donald Trump, focusing on immigrants. Well, I think a lot of that immigration, you know, Americans are seeing their jobs going to illegal immigrants coming into the nation. On Bernie Sanders' side, we see his push for the $15 minimum wage. I mean, he was on top of the $15 minimum wage far before Hillary Clinton was. This has been his baby, his solution for the problems. So I think there is this element of populism where the politicians are really playing to the problems of the nation. And I think this is probably one of those areas where we'll see, even going forward, politicians promising more and more to voters, especially in an election year.
So in a sense, it really is voters who are looking at this and recognizing a problem and seeking a simple solution and looking for some kind of a panacea. And it seems like a minimum wage, you know, on the surface, maybe it seems like the perfect solution. But the fact is, if this is the perfect solution, why not make it a $20 minimum wage or a $30 minimum wage? If it's just a matter of mandating that the entry-level job is paid a certain amount of money, irrespective of effects on the markets or whether this is going to cause businesses to go under or whatever the case might be, if that's the answer, a politician who is pandering to that is, it seems to me like that requires a certain amount of cynicism. It requires a certain amount of basically, I'm going to give the people what they want because I want this job. Whether or not it's right or wrong. And a politician who says, no, I'm not going to play to that. You have to look at the bigger picture. And these people who are insisting that this is the solution, they don't see the whole picture. I'm going to do what's right rather than what's popular. They're going to lose out to the one who makes the promises, isn't he?
you don't win elections by promising less. I mean, this is a lesson not only in U.S. history, but world history. The problem comes when you run out of things to promise. And I mean, that's the ultimate end game with these movements towards, you know, the state becoming ever a bigger portion of the economy, bigger government, more government spending, higher taxes. Where does it all end? And as we're seeing in various countries around the world today, many of these socialist nations that were just held up as examples a few years ago, I'm thinking of nations in South America. I'm thinking about nations in Europe, Greece, Spain, Portugal, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, nations that were held up as examples of, oh, look at this progressive socialism. Look at how much the government can provide for their citizens. You know, they've collapsed. They've run out of other people's money to distribute around. And ultimately, that's the end game in no matter where you are. You can push off laws of economics for a while. You can push off the effects of them for a while. You can hide them. You can paper over them. But eventually, you have to pay the piper. I mean, eventually, you know, the free lunch or the supposed free lunch that everybody thinks they're getting, you find out there's a paycheck at the end and it has to be paid.
We've been talking with Trumpet writer Robert Morley. He's writing an article on this subject, the $15 minimum wage. You can watch for that in the coming days on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you explaining this to us, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
How good is your memory? Perhaps you, like so many people, feel frustrated at your forgetfulness. I just read an article the other day that 37% of women, was it 73%? Like the old proverb goes, today is the yesterday that, or today is the tomorrow that you put off. And what did I come into this room for? Few of us have naturally great memories. Most of us have to work to improve it. But maybe you've never thought of this, but memory is like so many other aspects of life and this physical creation. God actually designed it to improve through repeated work. Generally, we only recall those things that we have repeatedly studied. How much easier would it be if you could hear something just once and retain it permanently? But easier isn't always good for you. God wants us to develop godly character. He created our minds to require consistent daily study in order to remember and recall things. And he made our memories to require exercise and discipline in order to become sharp. He wants to see how hard we're willing to work in order to remember things. Well, let's get into some points on how to improve your memory. First, remember by talking. If you want to remember something, talk to others about it. Share it. A large body of research shows that thinking about or discussing an event immediately after it occurs greatly enhances retrieval ability. This practice can also convert short-term memories into a long-term, more permanent form. Second, remember by being impressed. Whether something locks into your memory depends on the strength of the impression it makes when you encounter it. It's like driving a nail into a board. If you tap on it lightly, it's not going to penetrate and fasten. Something that makes a slight impression on your mind will fade from your memory. Whatever you want to remember, think of ways to make it make a stronger impression on your mind. Take notes, spend time with them, read them aloud to yourself, rewrite them in a form of a test, whatever it takes. Third, remember by concentrating. And this closely applies to the last point. When you study, you're not going to remember much if you're just reading casually and quickly like you'd read a novel. Studies show the act of concentrating releases hormones that set off a chain reaction of signals through memory-forming areas of the brain. When studying, eliminate distractions, turn off the music, silence the phone, turn off the email. The more you concentrate like this, then the easier it becomes and the better you will get at it. Fourth, remember by meditating. Think about what you study. Ask yourself how it applies to you, what lessons you should take from it. If you're studying the Bible, when you read about a principle of Christian living, ask yourself whether you're obeying that principle. When you face a decision, think about which scriptures apply to the situation. When you read prophecy, consider whether there's a current fulfillment. And then when you read the news, ask yourself which prophecies are being fulfilled. When you have moments throughout the day, think about what you have been studying. And the more you do, the more you'll remember. And finally, remember by repeating. If you encounter something only once, you're likely to forget it. Go over it again and again, and you'll drill it in. In fact, studies show that the key to locking things in long-term memory is repetition at precisely timed intervals. After you hear a lecture, for example, get a first quick review in as soon as possible. Within 24 hours, review it again. This one-day-after refresher is shown to boost memory back to around 95% of what you originally knew. Then do it again a week later, even if it's only for 5 minutes. Every time you review and repeat what you need to learn, you make the impression in your mind a little deeper until it is locked into your long-term memory. Your memory is an important gift from God. So work at it, use it, and build it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like this program, we'd like to give you a subscription to the Trumpet Magazine. This is our monthly news magazine featuring the writers you hear on this show. To receive the Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. You can also find daily analysis of the events of the day and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Andrew Locher, and Robert Morley. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Aesop. We hang the petty thieves and appoint the great ones to public office. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.